Okay, so this evening we are continuing our series looking at the life of David and the various relationships he had and the various encounters he had and what we might be able to take from them for our own lives. And tonight, although he wasn't named in the reading we had, we're thinking about David and Goliath, a very popular Sunday school story, so I suspect most of us will have done David and Goliath in Sunday school at some point, either when we were little ones or we've taught about it. So I feel like I'm teaching into something people know quite well already. So we'll see how that goes. But I thought it might, as it is a bit of a dive service, we have a bit longer, I thought it might be just worth looking a little bit at the history, the context of this conflict, and how long it had been going on for, particularly this conflict with Philistia, with the people called the Philistines. Now, the Philistines, they lived in an area on the southern coast of Canaan, on the Mediterranean. If you think of the Mediterranean coast as it goes down Israel towards the south there, just before it turns to go off to Egypt, that bit there. And the main cities of Philistia were Ekron, Ashdod, Ashkelon, Gath, and Gaza. Some of those are still towns and cities today, and we're particularly familiar perhaps with Gaza. So if you've seen those maps on the news telling you where Gaza City is, that's Philistia, there and just a bit north of there. And where do we first come across the Philistines? Well, it is really early in the Bible. It's right back in Genesis. The Philistines are noted as descendants of one of the sons of Noah in Genesis 10. So they've obviously been there right back from the beginning of the history of the people of God. And then actually, as we go through the time of the patriarchs, Abraham and Isaac, they both spent time living in that area noted as the land of the Philistines. Now at that time it was mostly a peaceful interaction. There were some disputes, mostly over watering rights for flocks. They were all nomadic people with lots of flocks of sheep and goats, and disputes over water in an arid land aren't uncommon. So there were some disputes over there, and disputes over who had dug which well and therefore had rights to that water. But in general, they got on pretty well. And then, of course, the people of God had moved to Egypt following Joseph. They'd spent some time in Egypt and had been enslaved there. And God sent Moses to lead them into freedom, out of Egypt and into the promised land. And then as on that journey out, when we get to Exodus 13, we read something really interesting on the way through, on the way out of Israel. It says this: when Pharaoh let the people go, God did not lead them on the road through the Philistine country, though that was shorter, for God said, if they face war, they might change their minds and return to Egypt. So God didn't lead them through Philistia to the promised land because they weren't ready for that conflict, and God didn't want them to be discouraged. And when they did eventually get to the promised land, the area where the Philistines lived, that was allocated to the tribe of Judah. We see that in Joshua 15. But those cities, they weren't taken over until late in the invasion. It's not until we get right into Judges, in Judges 1, we read that Judah took Gaza, Ashkelon, and Ekron. But even at that point, there were still Philistines living in the area and Philistine cities that weren't taken. If we skip forward, we come to Judges. Judges 3. Where are we? Where's Judges gone? Joshua. We've been done the whole of Judges. Joshua. Judges 3. Here we go. It says this: these are the nations the Lord left to test all those Israelites who had not experienced any of the wars in Canaan. He did this only to teach warfare to the descendants of the Israelites who had not had previous battle experience. The five rulers of the Philistines, all the Canaanites, the Sidonians, and the Hivites living in the Lebanon mountains from Mount Baal Hermon to Lebo Hamat. They were left to test the Israelites to see whether they would obey the Lord's commands, which he had given their ancestors through Moses. And then as we read through Judges, we did Judges last term, didn't we? Samson and all that lot. And who was it most of the time they were fighting? The Philistines. It's a bit like, I'm trying to think of a parallel for this. They were like the national enemy of the people of God. It was a bit like the English and French in the Hundred Years' War. Never-ending, back and forth, conflict of attrition, flaring up into open conflict every so often. It just, they were always there. And neither side ever really won. Very disheartening and dispiriting kind of conflict. And so, all the way through Judges, it's the Philistines. And then, eventually, we get to 1 Samuel, and we discover the final judge and prophet, Samuel. Where in chapter 4, we find the Philistines defeating the people of Israel, and this time taking the Ark of the Covenant, the Ark that God had told the people of Israel to make, the Ark that held the tablets of the law, Aaron's staff and the manna, like the thing from the Holy of Holies, the symbol of the presence of God with the people, the Philistines took. And they installed it in the temple of Dagon, who was their god, in Ashdod. This does not go very well for the Philistines. Firstly, the statue of Dagon in the temple kept falling over. It kept collapsing. They put it up and they'd come back the next day and it had collapsed again. And then a plague overtook the city. In the end, the people of Ashdod said, right, okay, we've had enough of this. So they sent it to Ekron. I'm sure the people of Ekron were very pleased. But they didn't really want it bringing judgment on them. So in the end, they sent it back to Israel along with, and this is really strange. So the plague they had was like a bubonic plague. It made swellings come up on their body. So they made gold copies of these tumours and sent those with the ark as some kind of restitution. Very odd. Anyway, they sent it back to Israel. And following that, Samuel did lead the people of Israel to subdue the Philistines. And there was a peace of sorts for some time, until Samuel was getting quite close to the end of his life. And it was at that point that the people of God decided they'd had enough of judges, they wanted a king. And God directed Samuel to anoint Saul king. Now, Saul had a son, Jonathan, and in a couple of weeks we're going to be exploring the friendship between David and Jonathan. So I'm not going to talk about Jonathan very much, but he did have a role in this ongoing conflict with the Philistines. Now remember, it's been relatively peaceful with the Philistines for some time. But then in 1 Samuel 13, verse 3, we read this. Jonathan attacked the Philistine outpost at Geba, and the Philistines heard about it. Well, surprise, surprise. Then Saul had the trumpet blown throughout the land and said, "Let the Hebrews hear." So all Israel heard the news. Saul has attacked the Philistine outpost, and now Israel has become obnoxious to the Philistines. And the people were summoned to join Saul at Gilgal. And so the conflict is reignited again by Jonathan poking the bear by attacking the Philistine outpost. Now on this occasion, the Philistines are routed. Again, nothing is permanent in this conflict. It's only a temporary defeat. As it says in 1 Samuel 14:52, all the days of Saul, there was bitter war with the Philistines. And that brings us up to 1 Samuel 17, and the latest installment in this long and bitter war. It's almost everlasting conflict. Now, at the beginning of this chapter, we find the two armies, the two opposing armies, the Philistine army and the Israelite army, encamped on hillsides facing each other across the valley. And every day, out of the Philistine army would come this giant of a man, Goliath. And he'd come out from the Philistine army and he would issue a challenge to single combat to the armies of Israel. And they were terrified. They couldn't respond. There was nobody who could take on this huge giant of a man. And this lasted for 40 days. 40 days. Now, why so long? Well, one commentator I read suggested that as both armies were camped on hillsides on opposite sides of the valley, neither wanted to give up the advantage of the high ground, because whoever blinked first and went down into the valley to attack back up the hillside the other side would lose the advantage of the high ground, and they would be trying to charge uphill facing either a static battle line or people charging downhill at them or firing arrows down on top of them. So neither army really wanted to start the battle by starting to head downhill, and that seems to make sense for me. Whatever the tactical military kind of reasons for it, it's a long time, isn't it? Just imagine it. Nearly 7 weeks of being on the edge of conflict, of being threatened, of not knowing what to do about it. As I was reading, it reminded me a bit of the report of the spies that Moses sent into the land when the people of God first arrived on its borders, when they were fleeing from Egypt. They got to the promised land, you may remember, and Moses sent some spies out into Canaan to have a look, see what it was like, see what was waiting for them when they went in. And they reported back in Numbers 13, they said, yes, it's great, there's loads of crops, land flowing with milk and honey, grapes, it's all great, it's lovely. But all the people we saw there are of great size. We seemed like grasshoppers in our own eyes, and we looked the same to them. We seemed like grasshoppers in our own eyes. That's how those spies felt. And that fear was contagious. The people refused to enter the promised land, and they were sent off to wander around the desert for another 40 years. And as their descendants, who did eventually make it into the promised land, looked down into the valley and saw Goliath challenging them, seems to me they felt the same way. We seem like grasshoppers in our own eyes. Small, insignificant, easily squashed. And in that Israelite army, feeling like grasshoppers, and probably feeling quite ashamed of it, were three of Jesse's sons, Eliab, Abinadab, and Shammah. And we met those three about a month ago when Richard was helping us explore David's anointing at the hands of Samuel, when they were all passed over, if you remember, for being anointed in favour of their younger brother. Now, at this point, David, that younger brother, is running back and forth between home and the army, bringing supplies to his brothers and news back to his father. And on his latest supply run, he arrives just as Goliath comes out to make the daily challenge. And David hears this and shows curious and indignant about it, coming across maybe slightly brash, slightly cocksure, typical teenager. His brothers hear him. Give him a flea in his ear. I wonder if there are echoes here of the interactions between Joseph and his brothers. Is Eliab still sore that David, that it was David Samuel had anointed and not him? Is some of that shame at being made to feel at being they felt at being made to feel small coming out in a desire to make someone else feel small? To cut them down to size. David's reply is pure teenager. Now what have I done? Can't I even speak? But he does, of course, keep asking questions, and his questions reach the king's ears, and Saul sends for him. David's bravado continues. He's going to go and fight the giant. Saul won't hear of it. He can only see the boy in front of him, not the king that God has chosen. So, as 1 Samuel 17 goes on, David shares some of his story. He might not have been on the battlefield against men, but he has fought against lions and bears, protecting his father's flock. David trusts that the God who delivered him from the wild animals will enable him to defeat the one who is mocking God and God's people. He has been prepared both practically, physically with the skills he needs, and also spiritually. He knows that his strength comes from God. And at first sight, it seems like Saul acknowledges the source of David's confidence and supports him in it. He says, "Go, and the Lord be with you." Tick. But then his actions don't actually line up with this. It's almost as if Saul, yeah, believe in God, but have a backup plan as well. Here, have my armour. He tries to fit out David in armour that he's not used to, doesn't fit him. And to be honest, even if it had, it would have been completely pointless. Let's have a look in, where are we? 1 Samuel 17, verse 5. This is Goliath's equipment. You ready? He had a bronze helmet on his head, wore a coat of scale armour of bronze, weighing 57 kilos, and a bronze javelin was slung on his back. His spear shaft was like a weaver's rod, and its iron point weighed about 7 kilograms. What use was a helmet and a light mail shirt going to be against us? I don't know how long a weaver's rod is. I'm assuming it's a very long stick. And a 7 kilo spearhead. None at all. David was quick to realise this and took them off. He knew who he was. He knew whose he was. He knew what skills God had given him. And he wasn't going to be weighed down with other people's good intentions or better ideas. He was going to operate as the person God had created and formed him to be in this situation. And so, finally, we've reached the conflict with Goliath itself, the details of which Sue read for us a little while ago. Goliath approaches, confident in his strength, in his armour, in his weaponry. And to be fair to him, it did look like a mismatch. Almost an insult to send out this virtually unarmed boy against this mighty warrior. And David was also confident. But his confidence was not in his strength of arms, but in God. I wonder if he knew the story of Gideon, sent out against a massive army, this time Amalekites actually, not Philistines, but massive army nonetheless, with only a few hundred men. Why was he sent out with such a small company? So that God's strength and power could be seen, and so there could be no question about the source of the victory. God says, I'm going to send you, I don't want you thinking, or the Israelite people thinking you've done this. I want you to know that I've done this. So I'm sending you with a really small army. I wonder if that story inspired David in those moments. He goes in the name of God. And I spoke this morning about what it means to do things in the name of God, so I'm not going to repeat all of this morning's sermon. Suffice to say that by claiming to be acting in the name of God, David was claiming an authority to do what he was doing as God's representative in this situation. He was anointed king, and although that wasn't yet known, he was operating as that in this situation. The recognized king was hiding in the back lines. the unrecognized king was living out his call to lead God's people with courage. He did what he knew how to do. He had selected some smooth stones from the riverbed. He collected them, he put them in his bag, and now he put one of those stones in the sling and flung it at the approaching giant. It hit him on the front of his head and he collapsed, dead. The Philistine army broke and ran, pursued by the Israelite army, and chased them all the way back to Gath and to Ekron. David had been victorious, and by him God delivered the people from this phase of the conflict with the Philistines. Sadly, though, that wasn't the end of the conflict. It continued to grind on for generations. In the end, right at the end of 1 Samuel, we find Saul dying in a battle with the Philistines. And although that in his reign David did have some successes against them, they continued to be a thorn in the sides of the kingdoms of Israel and Judah, right up until the exile to Babylon. Coming back to chapter 17, if we were to read on in chapter 17, we would come across some material that raises a question, a conundrum even. And that is, when did Saul and David meet? A couple of weeks ago, we were exploring 1 Samuel chapter 16 as part of understanding David's and Saul's relationship with all its ups and downs. And in verse 18 of chapter 16, David is described as a brave man and a warrior. In verse 21 of chapter 16, we read, David came to Saul and entered his service. Saul liked him very much, and David became one of his armor bearers. But at the beginning of chapter 17, David is clearly not serving in Saul's court. He's still working as a shepherd. There's no suggestion of recognition of David when he's brought before Saul in verse 32. In fact, Saul calls his experience of war into question. And as we noted earlier, David doesn't defend himself as a warrior, but as an experienced shepherd with the experience of fending off wild animals. He's no longer an armor bearer. He literally can't bear the armor. And then when we get to verse 55 in chapter 17, we find Saul watching David to go out to meet Goliath, asking his commander Abner, "Abner, whose son is that young man?" Something he had been told repeatedly in chapter 16. In verse 22, we read of him sending word to Jesse saying, "Allow David to remain in my service, for I am pleased with him." So what are we to make of this? We could attempt to harmonise the two accounts of chapter 16 and chapter 17. I've read a few in the commentaries as I've been preparing. I'm yet want to read one which convinced me at all, to be honest. Seems more likely that these two accounts came from different traditions about how the two met. They're not wildly different. The details and some of the timings just a bit different. Whoever God led to pull the history of the people of God together that we have in our Bible in this form, they weren't daft. They knew that the two didn't quite line up, but chose to include them as they are, without tidying them up, without trying to make them match. Just gave them to us, so we could chew over them and think about them. Because the two accounts both have theological truths to teach us. Be honest, it doesn't particularly bother me that they can't both be entirely historically accurate. Exactly what happened must be in the middle there somewhere. They both have slightly different things to say to us. One emphasizes the interactions between David and Saul and how David was sent to comfort Saul. The other speaks more about David's trust in God. We can't know exactly how David and Saul met, I don't believe. But we can say that in the early days of their relationship, David ministered to Saul. We can say that we know that David showed immense bravery and faith. And we see that his increasing renown led to Saul becoming more and more jealous of him, as we talked about last time. But to bring it back to David and Goliath and what their encounter, what their relationship, if you can call it that, can teach us about our lives and encourage us in. It seems to me that it prompts some questions that we might want to reflect on, that we might want to think about, might want to pray over, talk about in our small groups. Just thinking about that long conflict with the Philistines, I wonder if in our lives we ever experience a long conflict that has just worn us down. And I wonder what it would look like to bring that to God and ask him to work his peace in it, to restore us where we've been worn down by a long and lasting conflict. I wonder if there are situations or people that make us feel like a grasshopper, that make us feel small and insignificant and easily squashed. I wonder what it would look like to bring that feeling to God and say, this is how I'm feeling, Lord. Would you help me, please? Would you encourage me? Would you strengthen me? Would you help me see myself as you see me, as a beloved child, not as a grasshopper? I wonder if there are situations where we see people who have been worn down, who are feeling like grasshoppers, who have been squashed. And we come in and we can see the problem. How do we approach that? How do we encourage them? Are we like David, like his brash teenager? What's the problem? Why aren't you doing something about it? That doesn't always go down well. How can we gently encourage people to courage? And when someone is trying to encourage us, how do we react? With defensiveness, like those brothers? As we think about David's story and how he saw God's preparation in his life as a shepherd for the works that God had prepared for him to do in challenging Goliath, in leading as king, I wonder if we look back on our lives, I wonder if we can see God's hand in preparing us for the things that he's calling us to do. I wonder what God is preparing us for now. I wonder what the giants are in our lives. I wonder if we ever feel like we're wearing someone else's armour, that we're being forced or persuaded into a role that doesn't really fit us, to wear stuff that doesn't really fit us. What it would look like to step up and say, actually, this isn't doing me any good, it's not going to help. God has prepared me, as me, to be in this situation as I am, with the skills and provisions he's given me, and I'm not going to be weighed down by your expectations or your better ideas. And I wonder what our smooth stones are. Those simple, well-worn, perhaps, habits of Bible reading, of prayer, of meeting with others, that form the smooth stones of our discipleship that enable us to take out the giants, to be who we are, to trust God, and to live faithfully. Amen.